Welcome everybody. For the Sutta class on Majjhima 66, the Latoki Gopama Sutta, which has a Pali parallel in the Majjhima Agama, has a Chinese parallel in the Majjhima Agama, number 192, called the Kaludayi, the Dark Udayan, rather than the Simile of the Quail. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the country of the Anguttarapans, somewhat curious name, where there was a town of theirs called Apana. Then when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went into Apana for alms. When he wandered for alms in Apana and had returned from his alms round after his meal, he went to a certain grove for the day's abiding. Having entered the grove, he sat down at the root of a tree for the day's abiding. Meaning meditation, of course. The day's abiding, Diva Vihara. When it was morning, Venerable Udayan dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he too went into Apana for alms. So, Patajivaram, Udayan, got literally bowl and robe. When he wandered for alms in Apana, he had returned from his alms round after the meal, he went to the same grove for the days abiding and sat at the root of a tree. Then, while the Venerable Udayan was alone in meditation, the following thought arose in his mind. How many painful states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many pleasant states has the Blessed One brought us? How many unwholesome states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many wholesome states has the Blessed One brought us? Then, so it's very nice, the thought of gratitude for the Buddha. Okay, so, according to Analo, his present appreciation, however, stood in contrast to the discontent he had experienced at the time when the Buddha instructed the monks to abstain from eating in the afternoon and at night times. Which is, where does that occur exactly? That was the Bhadali Sutta. We have Bhadali didn't want to eat at night. So that's Bhadali. Wasn't there another one? 65 is the Bhadali Sutta. Not the not the Udaya. There's one before that, yeah. There was another one where he was watching him stop eating. No, we have had Udayan arguing with Ananda about the different kinds of feeling. There was in the Bahuvedaniya Sutta in the Majjhima 59. I'm not quite sure what Ananda is referring to there. I'll just double check that. The last one we talked about the prohibition for not eating, but then that was 59, there's another mark, maybe 59. Maybe an alias. It doesn't seem to have it in. Yeah, maybe just a slip up of an alias there. Not sure about that. Okay, it does give a footnote here, but not about that particular point. Footnote here. Blah blah. Bodhi in Yanamoli blah blah blah, which is the middle of the discourses, points out that the Vinaya account at blah blah, Vinaya 485, concerning the regulation to abstain from taking food during a period from noon till the next day's dawn, does not mention such a successive prohibition. Okay? So here we have the successive prohibition. Actually, I should read through and get to the successive prohibition first. Analeo doesn't discuss much on this because there's not much difference between the Pali and Chinese. When it was evening, Venerable Udayan rose from meditation, went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and told him about his reflections. Venerable Sir, formerly... Oh, hang on, it's here in the text itself, isn't it? It's Udayan saying, sorry. Formerly, we used to eat in the evening, in the morning, and during the day, outside the proper time. Then there was an occasion when the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, please abandon that daytime meal, which is outside the proper time. Venerable Sir, I was upset and sad, thinking, faithful householders give us good food of various kinds during the day, outside the proper time, yet the Blessed One tells us to abandon it. The Sublime One tells us to relinquish it. Out of our love and respect for the Blessed One, and out of shame and fear of wrongdoing, we abandoned that daytime meal, which was... Bhagavati. So because of our pema, so this is a word that's always used to refer to the love for the Blessed One, Bhagavati pemancha, garavancha, and respect for the Blessed One, hirincha, otapancha, the sense of conscience, hiri and otapa, then we abandoned that eating in the wrong time. Okay? So then we ate only in the evening and the morning. Okay? Then there was an occasion when the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, bhikkhus, please abandon that night meal, which is outside the proper time. So first of all, he told them to abandon eating in the afternoon, according to this, and then later on to abandon eating in the night. Venerable Sir, I was upset and sad, thinking the Blessed One tells us to abandon the more sumptuous of our two meals. The Sublime One tells us to relinquish it. Once, Venerable Sir, a certain man had obtained some soup during the day, and he said, put that aside and we'll all eat it together in the evening. Nearly all dishes are prepared at night, few by day. Out of our love and respect for the Blessed One, and out of shame and fear of wrongdoing, we abandoned that night meal, which was outside the proper time. Okay, so two stages of abandoning. It seems a bit curious that first of all we abandoned the afternoon meal and then the nighttime meal. But anyway, that's what the text tells us.
Maybe Vinaya
forgot that one. Yeah, this and that whole thing doesn't occur in the Vinaya, as in Alio's little note head here. Well, a little note head, massive Maha note here, says Bodhi points out the Vinaya account concerning the regulation to abstain from making food in a period from noon to the next day's dawn does not mention such a successive prohibition. The account regarding this rule in the Vinaya Vibhangara Sarvastivada Bhikshu Prati Moksha also does not speak of a successive regulation.
But why does he expect from it? Because he keeps saying that it's outside of the proper time. So if it's outside the proper time, then the proper time, it sort of refers to the proper time is already set.
It's the proper time is already understood.
And then they had this outside of the proper time, so it's like there's no two regulations. It's one regulation, and then you abandon the first one, and then you abandon the second one. Both of them, you know, are outside the proper time.
Kind of, it's a bit kind of ambiguous, because the use of the word the proper time, I mean, Vikala is that, like, literally the not time or the outside the time or something like that.
It's already, but
maybe not taken so seriously. Yeah.
That's another thing than saying that it's been done successively.
Yeah.
That the rule has been set successively. Yeah. I just don't understand why you understand that from the text.
Because it's first of all it says don't eat in the afternoon, and then it says don't eat in the evening.
So no, that's not what the text is. But at least the translation. I didn't read the Pali, but the translation says he refers to both abandonment as being outside of the proper time.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like that the proper time was stop eating at noon, and then first they relinquished the afternoon outside proper time, and then they stopped the night time outside proper time. To both of them he refers to as being held as outside of the proper time.
Yeah, I understand that.
So,
but it's still successive, because he mentions first of all the afternoon and then the evening.
Yeah, about being successive ruling. In the rule.
In the vineyard.
Always, the vineyard rule is not successive, and it doesn't refer here as well.
Maybe before they had the Vibhanga, this is the way that they could understand what outside of the time meant by referring back to this.
I think the interesting point about it is that just the way that it's phrased, that it's just the Buddha encouraging to do that, rather than this is not actually laying down a vinaya rule.
Mm-hmm.
So the laying down a vinaya rule is a different one. But there is a tendency within Pali to use language sometimes in that way, which is a bit kind of value laden. So that word like vikala actually doesn't in itself mean wrong time or something like that, but it's actually used in a value laden sense, which is interpreted to mean wrong time. So it was probably, may well have been understood generally that there was a right time to eat and a wrong time to eat, but not necessarily understood exactly what that was. So that the actual defining of that. There's quite a few places actually where it says in a kind of less, like say in the Sutta Nipata, or less legalistic contexts, where eating at the wrong time seems to mean basically eating at night time. So maybe that was the original meaning of it, I'm not sure. Anyway, blah blah blah. Interesting, Nali only refers to the Sanskrit text of the Sarvastivada Bhikshu Prati Moksha, which is unlike him, because normally he's very thorough in these things, but I guess the sheer bulk of Vinaya material had defeated him at this point. The fact that the promulgation of the Vinaya rule may appear to have taken place after the two successive instructions to abstain from afternoon and evening meals. In other words, he gave instruction, just a general guideline, and then only after that was actually a formal legal rule laid down. Okay. Anyway, he gives a bit of discussion about that. That moves to make money, so. Okay. But anyway, the much more interesting bit is the next part.
Would a better translation of Bikala be other time? I know in India they say Videsh, which means other country.
It can be a time. Outside the time.
The other.
Yeah, outside the time. Yeah, something like that.
Not value laden.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it only gets its meaning because of the way it's used in context. Yeah. V itself just means separate in that context, yeah. Okay, it has happened. Bhutapubang bhante. So bhutapubang being the usual idiom for once upon a time. Okay. A certain man, there is a man, Charami. I went wondering. Okay, so I'm just trying to figure out the paragraph here. Okay. It has happened, Venerable Sir, that bhikkhus wandering for alms in the thick darkness of the night have walked into a cesspool, walked into a sewer, walked into a thorn bush. And walked into a sleeping cow. Sutampi Garving. And they have met hoodlums who have already committed crime and those planning one, and they've been sexually enticed by women. Okay, literally, Matugamopi. Matugama. It's interesting in the suttas, it always. Yeah, it uses kind of matugama for women. Matugamopi te asaddhamena nimanteti, is invited for what is not the true Dhamma. Women invite them for what is not the true Dhamma. So, bumping into a cow, I heard a story about that once. A fellow told me a story about how he bumped into a cow and a bunch of cows. Anyway, I won't go into that. Right, and once, Venerable Sir, I was wandering for alms in the thick darkness of the night. Yes, Ratandhakara Timisa. Rata is the night, Andhaka is the darkness, andhakara. This is an idiom for like the thick blackness of the light, and the timisa also is the blackness of the darkness. A woman washing a pot saw me by a flash of lightning. Okay, vijantarikaya. So here vija is the lightning flash. And screamed out in terror. Bhita. So it's an intensive form of from bhaya, meaning scared. And then visaramakasi, made a visara meaning sound, and a visara is an intense sound. Yeah. So having made an intense sound from strong fear, i.e., screamed out in terror. So it's quite a nice little, very kind of vivid imagery. And then this little bit here, it says, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, mercy me, a devil has come for me. Right? Abhum me pisacho vatamanti. Sister, I am no devil, I'm a bhikkhu waiting for alms. Then it's a bhikkhu whose ma's died and whose pa's died. Mm-hmm. And because Matumari, whose mother's died, Atumari, I think there's some misspelling here, so it should be Pitumari, whose father's died. Better, Bhikkhu, that you get your belly cut open with a sharp butcher's knife than this prowling for alms for your belly's sake in the thick darkness of the night. Venerable sir, when I recollected that, I thought, how many pleasant states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many painful states has the Blessed One rid us of? How many pleasant states has the Blessed One brought us? And so it's a very nice passage and giving us a few examples of some quite colourful, colloquial Pali there. And Analio's note on that one... proclaiming that this monk's mother and father have died. As it stands in the Pali version, this remark is not easily intelligible. According to the commentary, the intended meaning is that one whose parents are alive will not need to go in search for food during the night. This commentarial explanation is not altogether convincing, since it was a general custom for monks and recluses in ancient India to subsist on begging food as part of their way of life. Thus, the idea that they should be fed by their parents instead of begging their food would not be what one would expect a woman in ancient India to be thinking. The Madhyama Agama version is able to provide a clarification for this puzzling passage. In its account, the reference to the monk's parents comes as part of a set of curses spoken by the frightened woman. Okay. Wishing that the life of this recluse and of his mother and father may come to an end and his whole clan meet with destruction. Seems a bit intense, doesn't it? Let's see if I can just find that out. Potential life. Atumari. Oh, what is Atumari? It says father's died. Atumari. That's very unusual for the father. It's very, very unusual language. Yeah, T. Hang on. Body number one. Okay. So, obviously, it's not easy being a monk. That's all you can say. Wandering around, all these things. It's interesting. In Buddhism, they don't talk about these things too much. But if you read the Jaina Sutras, it talks about that quite a lot. Actually, it seems to be a fairly major feature of the lifestyle, that when you're wandering around for alms, that people would abuse you and throw things at you and curse you and all of these kinds of things. It is, but it's much more so in the Jain ones, yeah.
Well, because that's because they're naked.
Yeah, they're naked and they never have a bath, and a few things like that might be a bit confronting. So, yeah. But, you know, I mean, sometimes you get this kind of feeling or, you know, saying, oh, well, in it's easy to go for alms around in somewhere like ancient India, but, you know, in Australia or something, it's not easy, but... Actually, you might have some difficulties in Australia. Somebody maybe call out a silly remark or something like that, but you're not going to be kind of cursed and have things thrown at you and all of these kinds of things. So actually, in some ways, it's probably easier than going in ancient India. And you need a bit of guts to do it, actually. Yeah. Okay. So, to Udayan, there are certain misguided men here who, when told by me, abandon this, say, what, such a mere trifle, such a little thing as this? Okay. Now, in this particular point, well, according to Analia, while in the Pali version, so this next passage that we've got here, the Buddha replying to Udayan, is a little bit abrupt. Udayan sort of finishes his bit, and then the Buddha starts out his immediately, which doesn't seem to follow on. While in Pali version, this comes as a little abrupt, the Madhyama Agama account has a smoother transition to this topic, reporting how the Buddha praised Udayi and contrasted him to those foolish ones who, unlike Udayi, were not appreciative of the Buddha's instructions. A similar transition may have earlier existed in the Pali version, since this passage begins with the phrase "in the same way." Evmeva, okay? So this phrase used by the Buddha, evmeva, is almost always used by the Buddha to like follow on from an example. He says, you know, something such and such has happened, evmeva, in just the same way, this. And so it's following on, but in this particular passage that previous paragraph seems to be missing, but it is found, something that works in that way is found in the Chinese. In the present version of Pali Discourse, this phrase hangs a little in the air, not really referring to anything, suggesting that some kind of transition may indeed be missing. So again, notice Analia's methodology here, which I think is quite good, and he's always very cautious about his claims. He doesn't just say, because the transition's rough, therefore it must have been something different or something like that. He uses both two criteria. One is the actual narrative flow of three criteria he's using here. One is the narrative flow, the connection between the paragraphs. Secondly is the particular occurrence of a word which should refer back to a previous thing which is missing. And thirdly, the comparison with the Chinese text. Okay, so all of those three things taken together lead to a fairly firm conclusion that we've dropped out a passage here from the Pali. Okay? So this is good use of text-critical technique. And always have to remind this, because sometimes when we're studying and looking at the text in a critical way, it's very tempting to just think, oh, because you don't like something, or you think it should be a different way or something like that, therefore it must have been. And that's not good enough. Might be true, but it's not persuasive, you know? But when you see those reasons given like that, then it's very persuasive. Okay. This recluse is much too exacting. Okay. Adi salikatam evayang. Adi salika. Okay, much too exacting.
You skipped the first.
Sorry?
You didn't say we abandoned this.
Oh, sorry. So to Udayan, there are certain misguided men who, when told by me, abandon this, say, what? Such a mere trifle. Such a little thing as this. Kimpani masa, apamatakasa, oramatakasa. Yeah, apamatakasa. It's just such a tiny little thing. This recluse is much too exacting. And they do not abandon that, and they show discourtesy towards me as well as towards those bhikkhus desirous of training. Apachayam. Discourtesy. For them, that thing becomes a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Okay? So the Tesang Tang becomes a balavang. Strong dalhang, stout kirang, lasting abudigang, not rotting tullo, thick tether and thick yoke. Right. Suppose, Udayan, a quail were tethered by a rotting creeper and would thereby expect injury, captivity, or death. Now, suppose someone said, the rotting creeper by which that quail is tethered and thereby expects injury, captivity, or death is for her but a feeble, weak, rotting, cawless tether. Would he be speaking rightly? No, venerable sir. Okay, so this is the puti lataya. So here's the quail, la puti la tukika, la tukika. We are having such problems with this one. La tukika, probably onomatopoeic, I guess, probably sounding like a cuckoo, sounds like the name of it. So kunika is the bird. The rotting feather is a slightly unusual term there, but puti lataya is a rotting. Puti means rotting. Suppose, okay. No, venerable sir, for that quail, the rotting creeper by which she is tethered and thereby expects injury, captivity, or death is a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Okay. Udayan. There are certain clansmen here who, when told by me, abandon this. That say, what, such a mere trifle, such a little thing to be abandoned as this? The blessed one tells us to abandon, the sublime one tells us to relinquish. Yet they abandon that, and they do not show discourtesy towards me or towards those bhikkhus desirous of training. Having abandoned it, they live at ease, unruffled, subsisting on others' gifts, with mind as aloof as a wild deer. So for them that thing becomes a feeble, weak, rotting, cawless tether. Okay, so that's all, it's quite interesting that sometimes even though they may themselves feel that it's only a little thing or it's not important, but just out of respect for the Buddha, then they follow it along, and then it doesn't become a problem for them. Yeah, and it's just a little thing. Suppose, Udayan, a royal tusker elephant with tusks as long as chariot poles, full grown in stature, high bred and accustomed to battle, were tethered by stout leather thongs. But by simply twisting his body a little, he could break and burst the thongs and then go where he likes. Now suppose someone said, the stout leather thongs by which this royal tusker elephant is tethered are for him a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Would he be speaking rightly? No, Bhante. The stout leather thongs by which that royal tusker elephant is tethered, which by simply twisting his body a little, he could break and burst, are for him a feeble, weak, rotting, cawless tether. Okay. The slight difference between the Pali and the Chinese version there is that while the Pali version, they think that they still think that these things is a trifle, so they still sort of they still kind of feel that this matter doesn't really matter, but they do it anyway. Whereas in the Chinese, they don't even think about that; they just do it without thinking that this is a trifle. Okay. Okay, now the next one is one of my favourite passages. And here we go. Suppose we're dying. There are a poor, dalido, penniless, asako, destitute, analgio, unusual word, man, and he had one dilapidated hovel open to the crows. Ekang agarakang, o vilugang, not the best kind, okay? Not parama rupang, not the best sort. Here, rupa, of course, we usually mean translate as form or appearance, but also sometimes meaning type or sort, not the best sort. And one dilapidated wicker bedstead, not the best kind. And some grain and pumpkin seeds in a pot, not the best kind, and one hag of a wife, not the best kind. He might see a bhikkhu in a monastery park, sitting in the shade of a tree, his hands and feet well washed after he had eaten a delicious meal, devoting himself to the higher mind. He might think, how pleasant the recluse's state is, how healthy the recluse's state is.
Sukham vatabo samanyam, arogyam, healthy samanyam.
Um, If only I could shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe and go forth from the home life into homelessness. But being unable to abandon his one dilapidated hovel open to the crows, not the best kind, and his one dilapidated wicker bedstead, not the best kind, and his grain and pumpkin seeds in a pot, not the best kind, and his hag of a wife, not the best kind. The hag, at least his hag of a wife. Ekang jayikang. He doesn't actually say hag here, he just says... This is wife, but being unable to abandon those things, he's unable to shave off his hair, beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth. Now, suppose someone said the tethers by which that man is tethered, so that he cannot abandon his one dilapidated hovel, and so on and so forth. For him a feeble, weak, rotting, cordless tether, would he be speaking rightly? No, venerable sir, the tethers by which the man is tethered for those for him are a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke. Okay, now this particular passage always reminds me of this wonderful Tom Waits song called Francois Years. I don't know if anybody knows that, but here's the lyrics for it anyway. Sorry? Well, Frank settled down in the valley and hung his wild years on a nail that he drove through his wife's forehead. He sold his used furniture out there on San Fernando Road and assumed a $30,000 loan at 15.25% and put down payment on a two-bedroom place. Not the best sort. His wife was a spent piece of used jet trash, made good Bloody Marys, kept her mouth shut most of the time. He had a little chihuahua named Carlos, had some kind of skin disease and was totally blind. They had a thoroughly modern kitchen, self-cleaning oven, the whole bit. Frank drove the little sedan, they were so happy. One night, Frank was on his way home from work. Stopped at the liquor store, picked up a couple of Mickey's Big Mouths, drank them in the car on the way to the Shell station. He got a gallon of gas in a can, drove home, doused everything in the house, torched it, parked across the road, across the street laughing, watching it burn all Halloween orange and chimney red. Then Frank put on a top 40 station, got on the Hollywood freeway and headed north. Never could stand that dog. So for him, obviously, that was a weak, callous, rotting yeah, that's one way of going forth, yeah. Right, suppose you're dying. There were a rich householder, or a householder's son, with great wealth and property, with a vast number of gold ingots, a vast number of granaries, a vast number of fields, a vast number of land, a vast number of wives, a vast number of men and women slaves. So notice how it's kind of interesting in Indian idiom, and I guess this is probably quite well spread, but you know, you'd give a list of your possessions, your belongings, and all the things that you owned, and one of them would be your wife. Yeah, and of course it was a bit kind of offensive, to put it mildly, from our point of view. We have this kind of idea which is probably from the Enlightenment philosophy of the inherent dignity of man, and that you know, it shouldn't be owned. Yeah, but obviously that's a kind of a modern conception, the idea that you know, you can put the ownership of a wife or the ownership of slaves on a par with the ownership of horses or crops or lands or something is quite taken for granted. He might see the bhikkhu in a monastery park sitting in the shade of a tree, his hands and feet well washed after he'd eaten a delicious meal, devoting himself to the higher mind. He might think how pleasant the recluse's state is, how healthy the recluse's state is. If only I could shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. And being able to abandon his vast number of gold ingots, his vast number of granaries, his vast number of fields, his vast number of land, his vast number of wives, and his vast number of men and women slaves, he is able to shave off his hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Now suppose someone said the tethers by which that householder or householder's son is tethered are for him a strong, stout, tough, unrotting tether and a thick yoke, would he be speaking rightly? No, venerable sir, the tethers by which that householder or householder's son is tethered, For him, those are a feeble, weak, rotting, callous tether. Okay. So in the same way, the certain monks being told to abandon it, what they need to abandon, then their fetters are a weak, rotting, callous tether. So this is have this nice phrase here that they abide aloof like a wild deer, and the phrase in Pali is migha bhutena cetasa viharanti. They abide with minds like a wild deer. The migha is okay. Udayan, there are four kinds of persons to be found existing in the world. What for? This kind of opening, of course, very characteristic of the suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. Here, Udayan, some person practices the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. Okay, upadhi. The Bodhi is translated as acquisitions. Could be translated as stuff. Upadhi. It's not the same word as upadana, as grasping, but it looks a bit similar. Sometimes in meaning it tends to conflate with upadana, but is not from the same root. When he's practicing this way, memories and intentions associated with the acquisitions beset him. He tolerates them, he does not abandon them, remove them, do away with them, or annihilate them. Such a person I call fettered, not unfettered. Why is that? Because I've known the particular diversity of faculties in this person. Okay, so the thoughts come and you tolerate them, you don't get rid of them. So the upadhi has a twofold meaning. It both means the things that you're attached to, like it's given the example in the previous chapters, like your possessions, belongings, and so on and so forth, but also refers to the internal defilement, which isn't able to let go of them. So here he thinks about those things, so he thinks about his possessions, belongings, and so on in the past, and tolerates those thoughts. It doesn't accept them, allows them to stay. Then the next person does not tolerate them. He still has the thoughts and the intentions, the sankappa, upadhi pati sangyutta, connected with the upadhis. Sara sankappa sambadacharanti. This word, sambadacharanti, has this kind of meaning of something like being swept over with. Okay, so it has this meaning of that you're kind of subject to. So of course this is a very sort of common feeling in meditation and so on, that you're sitting there trying to control your mind and do your meditation, but these things kind of sweep over you. They feel you can't do anything about them. And the word here, sara, is memories. Okay, so sara is the word for memory. Okay. And sankappa, meaning thought or intention. So this phrase together has a kind of an implication, like the sara is harking back to the past and the sankappa is heading off to the future. So it has this kind of suggestion that you're not in the present, you're either going in the past or the future. Okay, and even though he gets rid of them, so this phrase is obviously quite a strong phrase and used in this context. Nadhiva says he does not tolerate it. Pajahati, he abandons it. We know deity. Gets rid of it, okay? Drives it away. Well, literally, vinodeti is he leads it off. Vyanti karoti, makes it disappear. Anabhavam gameti, literally drives it into non-existence. Okay. Okay. Some person practices the way to the abandoning of the acquisitions. While he's practicing, memories and intentions associated with the acquisitions beset him now and then through lapses of mindfulness. Okay. Kadachi. So now and then, kadachi, karahachi. So both kada and karaha being words for time. Okay. Words indicative of time. And the kadachi, karahachi is an idiom meaning now and then or from time to time. Sati sammosa is mindfulness. Sati sammosa is disappeared or confused. Okay. His mindfulness may be slow in arising. Dandho, slow. is mindfulness, maybe slow. See, this is interesting. We have this kind of idea that if you're going to be mindful, then you have to do everything very slowly. Yeah? And so this idea that mindfulness means being very slow. Yeah, it's kind of useful as a kind of exercise, but actually, Ajahn Buddhadasa had a point when he described mindfulness as being like the speed of reaction. Yeah, and so you can see here this is sort of pointing to that when something happens, that your mind is brought to it, your awareness is brought to it very quickly. Atta ko nam kipameva pajahati, and then even though his mindfulness has arisen slowly, but when it's arisen, then kipameva, right away, he gets rid of it. Just as if a man were to let two or three drops of water fall onto an iron plate heated for a whole day, the falling of the water drops might be slow, but then they would quickly vaporize and vanish. Okay. Here, some person, having understood that upadhi is the root of suffering, upadhi dukha samulante iti viditva, divests himself of the acquisitions, nirupadhi hoti, through the release in the destruction or the ending of the acquisitions. Here, sankhaya, from the root kaya, meaning
ending.
And being distinct from the word
destruction, and kaya with a long A without the H.
Meaning body. Very good.
Not your name yet?
No. I've just been trying to get a few points. I've been trying to get this over the last 6 months or so. This distinction between these two words. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. Such a person, of course, is unfettered. Visamyutto divadami. I say is unfettered, not samyutto, not fettered. Okay. Okay, so the Pali and the Chinese are basically identical all through this. The only difference here is that you've got this slightly unusual introduction of the indriya vaimattata, the knowing of the different distinction of the faculties of beings, the diversity of faculties. And in the Chinese, that particular phrase is different. The Chinese says that the Buddha explained that he decided the first three types to be still in bondage because any fetter is unwholesome, and the fourth type to be free from bondage since he or she has eradicated all fetters. So in this case, the Chinese is a bit more straightforward. It gives a fellow just a normal summary of what's happened, whereas the Pali introduces this thing of the indriya vaimattata, this distinction in the fetters. And the same expression occurs, we've just had that same expression last sutta in the Badali, the different kinds of arahants. And elsewhere it's also used to mean that the different kinds of noble disciples and the different levels of attainment according to which faculties have been developed. And so it raises the question about why that particular phrasing is used there in the Pali. And it's certainly maybe not possible to make a decision about that, but it's certainly the Chinese presentation is a bit more straightforward. The Pali one is a bit curious, at the least, why that particular category should have been introduced. Okay. Here, there are, Udayan, five chords of sensual pleasure. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. So, of course, the standard passage on the five, what they call strands. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates usually chords or strands. This is guna. Apparently, this understanding of guna, meaning cord or tie or strand, is found only in the Pali tradition. It's not found, according to my friend Stephen Hodge, it's not found anywhere in the northern commentaries or anything, so it seems a bit curious, but guna normally means a quality of something. So there's five qualities or aspects of sensuality. What are the five? Chakvinyaya rupa, so forms, the seeable things, to be cognized by the eye. Itta, that are wished for. Gamta, likable. Manapa, agreeable. Piya, rupa, of delightful seeming. So here rupa, we noted before, had a meaning of a kind. So here also has a meaning of kind, but also has a sort of an implication of seeming. Okay, so delightful seeming, pleasant seeming forms. Kāngupa sanhita, connected with sensuality, and radhaniya, so lust inducing, something like that. And the same for the other five senses. So of course this being referring to only the five external senses, then the sixth sense is implied in the final sentence. The pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five chords of sensual pleasure, or perhaps five aspects of sensual pleasure, are called sensual pleasure, a filthy pleasure. Mirha sukham. Pissy pleasure. That's right. A coarse pleasure. Putujana sukham. Common or for the noble, an ignoble pleasure, not of the noble ones. I say this kind of pleasure, that it should not be pursued, that it should not be developed, that it should not be cultivated, that it should be feared. Bhayitabham. Okay? That kind of pleasure should be feared. Here, Udayan, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters in upon and abides in the first jhana with the ceiling. And so on, so the four jhana formulas, as we've been through many times before. So this got this kind of passage with like the jhanas, you know, we've recited it so many times, and the things, you should really know them off by heart, yeah? And, you know, the four jhanas, the four noble truths, four satipatthanas, and things like that. It's always good to learn these things by heart and be able to know them in the Pali. Of course, it's even better to be able to get them. Right, but at least you can get them. If you both can do the meditation and know how to explain them, then that's very, very beneficial, because you both have a deeper understanding yourself about your own experience, and also it helps you to articulate and explain that to others. So this is called the happy bliss of renunciation, nekhamma sukha, bhavi, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of tranquility, peace, the bliss of enlightenment, sambodha sukha. This is to be cultivated, to be developed, to be made much of, and should not be feared. Okay, of course, this being one of Ajahn Brahm's favourite passages, and a very striking endorsement of the pleasure of meditation. And so this is, of course, is one of the ones which you should all know, and whenever you're told to be afraid of the happiness of meditation, then you say to them, the Buddha said the happiness of meditation is the bliss of renunciation, the bliss of seclusion, the bliss of peace, the bliss of enlightenment, to be cultivated, to be developed, to be made much of, and not to be feared.
How do you understand
Sambodhi
Sukha
in this context? Yeah, it's kind of unusual, isn't it? Mm. When Ajahn Brahm sort of says it, just because it's very close to enlightenment, or leading to enlightenment, perhaps?
As a quality, even similar to enlightenment.
As a quality similar to enlightenment, yeah.
But it's not the happiness of enlightenment, something just like.
No, yeah.
Because if you understand that other traditions get jhana experiences, and obviously it's not enlightenment.
And then think that they're enlightenment, yeah.
So perhaps it's just got a taste of it or something like that.
Yeah.
Perhaps because the arahants have four jhanas, and that's the bliss that they can abide in.
Yeah.
Not all of them have other.
The other attainments, yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough. Okay. Now, then the Buddha goes again into the jhanas. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome dhammas, the bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana. Now, this, I say, belongs to the perturbable. Injitasmin varami. Okay? So this is in the perturbable, the shakeable. And what therein belongs to the perturbable, the applied thought and sustained thought that have not ceased therein, that is what belongs to the perturbable. Okay, the vitaka vichara aniruddha honti. The vitaka vichara which has not ended, that is belonging to the perturbable. Similarly, the second jhana is also belongs to the perturbable. What is perturbable? Vipiti sukha. So of course these are the successively the coarser leading to more refined qualities which are abandoned during the process of the jhanas, and each one of them, even the upekha sukha, the bliss of equanimity in the third jhana, and then the fourth jhana, the Buddha says, is aninjitasming. This is not perturbable. Now there's a slight ambiguity in the way that the suttas treat this use of this word injita and aninja. Usually the fourth jhana is one of the classic words, you know, when it says having then he gets the fourth jhana and then he says with the mind thus purified, bright, malleable, wheel-leased, attained to imperturbability, aninja pate, then fourth jhana is normally said to be imperturbable, but there are some places also where it seems to be restricted to the formless attainments. Okay, but I think usually is the fourth jhana is said to be imperturbable, presumably because of the depth of equanimity there. Okay, so then the first jhana. Here again, going back third time, going back to the four jhanas, emphasizing these again and again. Someone gets into the first jhana, this I say is analam, not enough. Okay, alam. Okay, alam. Okay, so that should be not alam di. It's quite marked. Okay, analam di. It's not enough. Abandon it. Surmount it. Go beyond it. Hope to transcend it. And what transcends it? Here, bhikkhu gets, with abandoning of vitaka vichara, gets into second jhana. This, too, is not enough. Abandon it, transcend it. So, of course, the Buddha, not just praising jhanas, but praising, goes developing them more and more and more. Yeah, up to higher and higher jhanas, up to the fourth jhana. And the fourth jhana, this also one should abandon. How do you abandon that? How do you transcend it? Here it goes, bhikkhu, with the complete transcendent of perception of forms and the ending of perceptions of impact and resistance, not paying attention to perceptions of diversity, knowing or aware that space is endless, enters and abides in the base of infinite space. This transcends that. But this too is not enough. Abandon it. Transcend it. What transcends it? Here, a bhikkhu with the complete transcending of the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, enters and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. This transcends it. But that too is not enough. What transcends that? Here, a bhikkhu completely transcending the base of infinite space, aware that nati kinchi. There's nothing at all. Enters and abides in the base of nothingness. This transcends it. Then that too is not enough. What transcends that? Here, bhikkhu, having transcended the base of nothingness, enters and abides in the base of neither. Neva, sanya, na. This is actually na. Oops, na. Asanya. Okay? Neither perception nor non-perception. The ayatana. The ayatana literally meaning is from the word to spread out. So an ayatana being a domain or a field. Yeah? So the Bhikkhu Bodhi, I don't really like the translation of base that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses, but I might prefer like a field or arena. Hello. Excuse me, I've got to repair the text here. That transcends it, but that is not enough. By this time, the monk's thinking, "Blimey!" He's thinking, "Crikey, Lord, I've done all this stuff, and you're still telling me it's not enough. What is it that bans it?" Transcending that, he enters and abides in the Sanya Vedayita Nirodhaṃ. Okay, the cessation, Nirodha, of Sanya, and they say usually perception and feeling, although grammatically it's perception and the felt, more literally, but it's the same meaning. This is what transcends it. This abandons that. Okay. Thus I speak of the abandoning even of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Do you see, Udaya, any fetter, small or great, of whose abandoning I do not speak, no venerable sir? So quite interesting, of course, because he doesn't mention actually attaining arahantship, which is what you'd think. He just mentions getting up to the cessation of perception and feeling, and which is normally not regarded as a state of enlightenment, but here it seems to be wonders. Of course, this series of nine, what they call nine successive abidings, this is what Ajahn Brahm calls the pure samatha path. So according to him, the suttas don't teach a path of pure vipassana, but they do teach a path of pure samatha. And there actually is something to that, even though it's maybe a bit tongue-in-cheek, but certainly the way that it's presented quite explicitly here and in many, many other places in the suttas, you just go through this series of consecutively deeper samatha attainments, and that finally results in awakening. Usually, after here, it says something about you then overcoming all the defilements or something like that.
Chinese
says, blah, blah, blah. While both versions agree on the need to transcend the four jhanas and the four formless attainments, the Pali version stands alone in culminating this description of successive stages of transcendence with the attainment of cessation. This difference reflects a recurring general feature in that Pali versions of a discourse often have the attainment of cessation not found in their Chinese counterparts. Both versions report the Buddha making the concluding remark that he had spoken in favour of abandoning all types of fetters, small or great. Okay. So the Pali being the only one here, obviously all of them leading up through the samatha attainments and then to abandoning of all fetters, and the Pali putting this little extra bit in, maybe it was one a particular thing that was specially emphasized in the Pali tradition. Of course you do find it in the Chinese, but the question here is whether it's so regular or found in so many passages.
You think there's a bit of a contradiction in this when it says, first of all, that should not be feared, should be developed, should be made much of, not feared, and then at the end it's saying, these are fetters, these are some yojanas, and they should be abandoned.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a...
Yeah, it's not ambiguity, yeah.
So perhaps, I mean, they're only really fetters for the anagami, these states, up until that point, they're not fetters, are they?
Well, yeah, but also I guess, you know, depends. Yeah, it just depends on your point of view. If you need to develop them, then you need to develop them. Once you've developed them, then you need to go beyond them.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah, this is this Mahamoggallana's progress in the Buddha. He would get to the point the Buddha say, you know, that's not enough, and you just keep pushing him further and further.
Yeah.
Until he broke through.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is sort of progression there.
Yeah.
It's necessary progression.
Yeah.
Seems unusual that it uses the term sanyojana for lofty states.
Yeah, it is unusual.
And how are you still contemplate with them, you know, the form of time.
Yeah.
It was really, like, I noticed the difference between the people practicing and the time. I think this is the most people were happier. People practicing were passing the time.
Yeah.
And my friends, we said, yeah, you have to develop this very, very high energy and then you just have to give it all away.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And you know, obviously Panyo used to he could tell when Ajahn Chandiko had been doing Asubha Kamatana the night before, when he'd been doing breath meditation, or when he'd been doing Asubha the night before, when he had mood fallen down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's in a bit of a kind of gnarly mood, or a bit kind of short, or something like that. Then he's been indulging in the Asubha. Okay. So even though the exact details of the phrasing of this one is a little bit obscure, but the message of it is clear enough and very consistent in the suttas that the four jhanas need to be developed to overcome our attachment to sensual desire, which is a very strong fetter, and that the four jhanas and the blessed meditation is something which is very essential to help us to gradually get rid of those things. But even that is not itself enough, so we need to keep on practicing refining states of samadhi. Even if we think we've got good meditation, we need to keep on refining that. How much more so if we think we've got crap meditation? And until we can completely let go of everything, even letting go of good meditation. All right. Okay, any questions? Notes? Yeah, okay, fair enough. This pushing and striving to attain states contrasts somewhat with the way meditation is often described as letting go and wanting nothing. So yes, that's true, and there are those two kind of dynamics, and I think both of those dynamics have to be present. Like, in one respect you have to say, go for it, strive, push, you know, attain. And on the other hand you have to say, oh, well, let go, be peaceful, take it easy. Because neither one of those are absolutes. They're both just ways of talking ultimately, yeah. And when you're meditating, it's just a mind, and you're just there with awareness, and neither of those things are happening. Obviously, when it comes together, it's in balance. So when things hit, like when meditation hits the sweet spot, yeah, it just flows very, very naturally. You get into the rhythm, and it's neither pushing and trying to get states, and nor is it letting go and relaxing. It's just there in its own inherent balance. And so that's the ultimate point. So before we get to that, we need to remind ourselves sometimes to sort of push and so on if we're getting a bit lazy, but then if we're getting tense and striving too much, we need to just let go. So sometimes in the time of the Buddha, they would have the Buddha to tell them which one was applicable at which time, and we don't have that necessarily, so we have to use our own discernment to find that out.
Word for unruffled,
unruffled. Panaloma. Yeah, panaloma. Loma is the hair. Kesaloma, hair of the body. Yeah. So the panaloma. Panna means all lying down together. Yeah, so the hair is all lying down together. Okay, so let's finish my paper space.